Hello, listeners. This is the Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland, and I hope you're having a great Labor Day. Today, John Harris, founding editor of Politico, is stepping in.
Okay. He just put his thumb up so I can start whenever.
The presidential campaign feels like it's been going on forever, but it's about to enter a new phase. So John Harris is joined by a slate of our national political reporters. We've got Holly Otterbein.
I cover 2020 for Politico. I'm based in Philadelphia.
Natasha Karecki,
national reporter for Politico. I'm spending a lot of time in Iowa.
And David Siders.
Cover 2020 for us and had been covering Beto O'Rourke quite a bit, and maybe still will be depending on how he does.
They have all spent the last year or so totally immersed in presidential politics, which is where they will stay for the next year or so. And they're going to tell us all about what they've learned so far and what is coming down the road. I'll let John take it from here.
Okay, it's Labor Day weekend. A year plus out from a presidential race. If this were a traditional presidential campaign, we would say, look, this is the beginning. Of course, it's not a traditional presidential campaign. In some ways, it's been going on for almost 2 years, ever since, or more than 2 years, ever since Donald Trump was first elected, surprising all of us, I think. The presidential campaign has been underway. But I still think this is an important date, an important milestone for us to reflect. What have we learned this past few very intense months this summer and here at the start of fall? What do we still have to learn about this presidential race before winter starts and when actual voting finally begins? One thing I'm curious to hear you guys talk about is charisma and how we're defining charisma in the Democratic contest in 2020. The most traditionally charismatic candidates, Beto O'Rourke being a great example, he's good looking, has an inspiring stump speech we all thought from his 2018 Senate race. He's kind of fizzled. Mayor Pete was attracting lots of attention for his style. He was seen as the charismatic, ascendant candidate, but he's struggling to stay in the top tier. And Kamala Harris, similarly, is showing the limits of traditional charisma. You know, her image as the razor-sharp, tough prosecutor, not really breaking through, and yet anti-charisma candidates, or people who traditionally haven't had what we thought of charisma, Elizabeth Warren being a good example, and probably Joe Biden being an example, they seem to be in command of this race. What have we learned about charisma, and why have all this anticipation around certain candidates, all the great press they got, hasn't seemed to translate into actual support? I'd like to hear you guys on that.
I think the question about charisma is a fascinating one, and it really gets at something that's going on in this campaign. You have Joe Biden in the lead, and you have basically tied for second Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, and none of them, as you said, are traditionally charismatic. Biden is a gaffe machine. Bernie gives a very passionate speech, but often says many of the same things and is kind of churlish. Elizabeth Warren is wonky and professorial. But what they all are, or I think what they all inspire in voters, is a sense of authenticity. You look at all of them, and in their own ways, because they're not polished, I think they come off as authentic. You know, the polish that we used to expect of candidates, it's not appealing to voters in the way that it used to.
I mean, I think what we've learned is that is the initial draw, right? I mean, that is why people were drawn to Beto, to Mayor Pete, and to Kamala initially. But I think the bottom line of what we're seeing across all the early states, across different demographics, is Democrats need more this time. They want someone with a clear message. They want someone who will take on Trump, and they want somebody who they can see as electable in the general election. And, you know, I think that's why Elizabeth Warren has done well. She, and I would argue, of the field, has the clearest message, and she has from the very beginning. And it's economic disparity, it's corruption in government, the system is rigged. And by the way, here's my resume and what I've done in the past about it.
Yeah, and this is David, and just from the perspective of having covered O'Rourke, the other side maybe of the Biden success coin, I think that the Democratic voters are looking for a clear message, and also I think for more substance to that message. You know, O'Rourke, on that first day he entered, had tons and tons of support and raised all sorts of money based on charisma and expectation alone. And I think he's now maybe righted the ship in terms of not having much of a policy platform, although I think to little effect. What hurt him at the beginning was really a perceived lack of substance. And I think he's a good example of Democrats wanting something more than an aspiration. And I think that might in part be a reaction to what they have in the White House, which is a huge personality and somebody who's, charismatic in some ways, I think Trump is, and that may be a reaction to that.
David, you were right there at the beginning with O'Rourke, though, at all his early appearances. You mentioned that perceived lack of substance. Is that a fair perception?
I think initially it was, in the same way that Barack Obama was criticized in 2008 or 2007 rather, for not having so much substance to his plans. And Obama managed to get through those early months and to get past that criticism. The double problem that I think O'Rourke, or what compounded the problem for O'Rourke, was that in the early months of the campaign, when nobody's advertising yet, or at least the advertisements are all online and directed at getting donors, they're not the broadcast TV advertising. I'm looking back at March, April. Almost all of the movement you're trying to get is through traditional press. And O'Rourke made two mistakes. One was having some deficiencies in his own candidacy. The other was, I think, ignoring national press and traditional reporters, thinking that he could run the same kind of thing he did in Texas, that he wouldn't need traditional reporters. He could simply go to Facebook. And so that's interesting in that it is a reminder, I think, that some of the traditional structures of a presidential campaign are still very much, very much in play.
And Holly, and really everybody, but start with you. Where does that leave Mayor Pete, who's certainly polished because he's so articulate? Does he also pass the authenticity test?
One test that he definitely passes is the fundraising test. In the second quarter of the year, he was able to fundraise more than anyone else, which is astonishing when you've got these, you know, major fundraisers in the race. Bernie Sanders with his giant email list, Joe Biden with all of his connections. Elizabeth Warren now has built up a real fundraising base as well, and he was able to trump them all. So I think we're going to, you know, he's going to keep on going. He has enough money to keep on going in this race. And I think that's one of the challenges that he's going to struggle with is, you know, can he appeal to people outside of the white, well-off, highly educated base that he's talking to right now? They appreciate the polish, but, you know, is he going to be able to speak to more demographics than that?
Those are all great points, Holly, and I agree with that. It seems like he is a strong, very strong niche. And you know, one of the things to look for is, can he expand that? But on the authenticity question, I think that is something that's drawing people to Mayor Pete right now. He has a very easy, calm way about him, and it does come across as, you know, not fake. It seems very authentic, and he's very quick on his feet. And, you know, he kind of moved into this, you know, when Beto was sort of struggling in the beginning, when, you know, he was perceived, however you want to say it, as not having these policy ideas because he kept, you know, he's going across the country and asking people, you know, what I hear from them. Mayor Pete sort of moved into that void and said, you know, he had a little more, Mayor Pete just seemed like he had more depth to him. He had thought through his answers, surprisingly, since he's only a mayor. But it just came across as, you know, very true to who he was.
Yeah, I think the point that that Pete kind of stole Beto's thunder is 100% right. I think that is part of what has led to Beto's downfall.
It's Labor Day right now. The next big milestone, probably Thanksgiving. Do we think Mayor Pete is going to still be in the top tier? He's right now, probably we'd all agree, kind of barely hanging in the top tier, largely driven on the strength of his fundraising rather than his polling performance. Is he going to be in the top tier still at Thanksgiving, do we think? And if so, what does he need to do between now and then? What do you think, Dave?
I think the fundraising keeps him in the top tier, and I think that there's been so little paid advertising that that we might, it might be easy to forget the significance of being able to drop millions and millions of dollars on TV if a candidate decided to do that, who was not a Tom Steyer kind of candidate, but a candidate who was already in that top tier. So I do think he has that going for him. I also think, I mean, part of the authenticity question is a question of gravitas, right? And to the extent that he's able to communicate, I think it will take more than, you know, keeping the 5 o'clock shadow for the debate. I think he's going to need to express some gravitas that projects an image beyond his young age. And he may be able to do that. And if he is, and if he can do that, especially through mass media, then I do think he hangs on and is in the top tier by Thanksgiving. And if not, you know, he probably slides a little bit. What's amazing to me is how static the race has been the last couple of months. I'm not sure there's a great reason to think that by Thanksgiving it changes dramatically one way or the other.
I mean, I would add with Mayor Pete that, I mean, one, he is someone I can see going far because he does do really well in debates. He just does. I mean, he's very clear. He's just a very good orator. And as I said, like, you know, after you see him at events, people will often say, God, he's such a calm about him. I can see him debating Trump. And that's how people, you know, that's how Democrats are looking at it. That's the lens they're looking at it. You know, and the other thing I'll say, there is natural enthusiasm for him. You know, Dave and I were at that Iowa Wing Ding recently, and you saw 22 candidates go up and speak, and several of them, you could just sort of feel the ground move. And definitely Elizabeth Warren, but Mayor Pete was another one. It was just like you could feel the enthusiasm in the room for him. So there's something there, and I think that's going to take him a little further than we think.
Holly, one of the big stories of the summer, of course, has been the strength of the Democratic Party's left. Do you think there's a significant division within the left between Warren and Sanders, what they stand for? Warren says, I'm a Democratic Socialist. Sanders says, I'm a Democratic Socialist. Warren says she believes in capitalism but needs to reform it. Is that a difference with any significance on the ground in presidential politics?
I think among activists, there's certainly a division about, you know, what is the best way to make change happen. Both Bernie and Warren see that answer to that question differently. I think in the voting base itself, it's interesting. Bernie and Warren have actually pretty different voters at this point in the primary. That could change, obviously. But Warren supporters tend to be more higher income, more highly educated, older, a little bit whiter. Bernie supporters are a little bit more diverse, younger, more male, less college educated. And so they are pretty different people, and you have to ask, why are they appealing to different populations when they do, at the end of the day, have a pretty similar left-wing populist message? And I think it speaks to the fact that this primary is about more than ideology. You know, we often talk about these lanes as, you know, the moderate lane or the progressive lane, and I think that it's just a little bit more complicated than that in these voters' minds. They're thinking about electability, they're thinking about authenticity, they're thinking about, you know, whether they want a woman in the office, they're thinking about, you know, who they trust, you know, who they think is the most experienced. And so right now, at this point in the primary, those questions are dividing the left more than the ideological questions of, you know, should the left rally behind Sanders because he's slightly to the left of Warren, or should it, you know, rally around Warren because, you know, she doesn't call herself a Democratic Socialist and maybe that will be more electable. It hasn't broken down that way quite yet. When they shared the debate stage last month, they both very clearly decided to not go after each other whatsoever and instead teamed up and kind of battled off the moderates on stage and did not go after one another. And I think that's partly because at this point, their voters don't overlap too much. That seems to be starting to change. In a couple polls, there's been evidence, for instance, that Warren has been eating a little bit into Bernie's younger base. So I think if that continues to happen, then we might see them do more battle or see their campaigns do more battle with each other.
Do you think come the fall we're going to have an open battle for the left, moving beyond these little digs from surrogates and little social media flare-ups? Do you think in the end this non-aggression pact between Sanders and Warren is going to break down because one of them is going to be carrying the banner for the left and the other is going to be an also-ran?
I think, you know, both campaigns say that they think that it will end up being a progressive versus a moderate in the end. There's an interesting question there as to whether or not that's true. I do think that that relies on an ideological view of the campaign, which I'm not entirely sure is the right one, at least at this point.
I like that view of this as not necessarily being an ideological. If you look at where voters migrate, it's not as if you stay in some, or the Democratic electorate stays in some progressive lane and, you know, selects his choice down the card of progressives. It tends to go back and forth based on a lot of other factors like the ones that she enumerated. So you have Biden supporters may go to Bernie, or Sanders supporters may go to Biden, or Harris supporters go to Warren. So I think there's evidence to suggest that she's exactly right.
You know, let me offer a view of that, which is it may not be an ideological campaign per se, but there clearly is strong pressure on all the candidates to take positions that are much further to the left than would have been than even Barack Obama would have regarded as sensible in his two presidential runs on Medicare for all, on decriminalizing border crossings, and so forth. Maybe the key difference, though, is part ideology and part stylistic. There's one candidate who represents politics as we have understood it for decades, Joe Biden, and there's no other candidate who's gaining a lot of energy, showing a lot of energy, who doesn't represent something different, which is let's fundamentally challenge the system and let's fundamentally practice a new brand of politics. Mayor Pete represents that. Both Senators Warren and Sanders represent that. A kind of demand, a hunger to shake up the system and not run politics as usual versus Biden sort of standing for the status quo or a return to the status quo from the Trump era. What do you guys make of that?
If I could weigh in, I think the reason Biden's getting away with that is because Donald Trump is in the White House. I think if it were a different dynamic, we might be looking at Democrats. I'd be looking at things differently. But, you know, he positioned himself and his team is selling him, at least, you know, to this point, very well as the person who can beat Donald Trump. I think that's kind of where Democrats are. They see Biden as someone who can be a uniter, not that they necessarily need, that they necessarily want a uniter, but they can see him winning in a general election. They can see some of these, you know, the Midwestern voters going for him. I think there is no question. I think no one would dispute that other candidates are exciting the base much more when you're at these events. But Biden's people would say that all these Democrats are moving too far to the left, and they're making a bad gamble. And that if you look at the Democratic electorate, the actual people who go to the polls, they're older, they're whiter, and they're more moderate. And Biden is aligned with them. So in that sense, he's able, he hopes, to say, it's me versus everyone else. And I know that, you know, lots of candidates would say, no, you know, I my differences ideologically are here and here, and it's not so far to the left. But right now, he's kind of gotten away with doing that.
Yeah, to just add to that, I would say that, you know, I think Biden's continued strength shows a couple things to me. One of the big stories that's come out of the primary is that, you know, the steady march of populism continues, right? Elizabeth Warren has had a surge. Bernie Sanders and her are tied for second. So that element of the Democratic Party is continuing on. But at the same time, another thing is happening, which is that Democrats are just so scared, and they have PTSD from 2016, and they're terrified of another 4 years under President Trump, and they just want to do anything to prevent that. And so in Joe Biden, they see the solution to that. And I think that his campaign will depend on whether or not he can continue to make people associate him with electability. Every time that he has a quote unquote gaffe, he risks losing that.
Let's talk about what's new in politics this year. It seems to me most presidential campaigns going back over the last generation, two generations, present some kind of innovation in how candidates communicate with and mobilize their voters. You know, Ronald Reagan was an innovator back in the day, because I'm going to skip over the mainstream media filter and talk directly with activists through direct mail. In the 1992 campaign, it was seen as a great innovation that Bill Clinton would use cable TV, and he'd go on Larry King or Arsenio Hall and show a different side of himself than presidential candidates historically have done. Recent years, we've had the Facebook campaign, and of course, President Trump has been the Twitter candidate. What's our best guess as to what 2020 is going to represent? What's going to be the signature innovation? What's going to be the breakthrough that will change how presidential campaigns connect with the American people?
I'm going to go with selfies, the selfie line. You know, is it an innovation? I don't know, but it has become the norm. I mean, if you're a candidate running for president and you're not taking selfies with the people who show up at your events, I mean, it's you know, you're a grumpy fool. Like, it is just, I mean, Warren has, you know, she has it down to, like, it's almost corporate-like, where, you know, here's a line, everybody get in line. And, you know, Biden stays until the end. Cory Booker will do videos with people. And there's just much more one-on-one talking to voters. It's not as much of, okay, I'm talking on a stage and then I will leave the stage and goodbye. It's people are just have more of an expectation to, like, be able to touch the person, take a picture with the person, say something, ask the question, get a little video. It's just much more human interaction.
Create intimacy, or at least the illusion of intimacy,
right,
out there on the campaign.
I think that point about the selfies may speak to maybe that's the innovation. I think it's the struggle that all the candidates are having, more so this year in the past, with small dollar donors who are giving to more than one candidate. How do you keep that list engaged beyond just the donation or signing up? I think the Warren model of bringing the paid comms all in-house to maybe try to be a bit more nimble. Maybe that ends up being an innovation. I do think when you look back at the innovations that have been repeated in the following election cycles, they tend to be cemented as the successful ones after they are successful. So I'm not sure if there's an anti-selfie candidate out there. But if that one won, for example, maybe everybody would put away their cell phones. But I do think those are some new things. And really the struggle of how to maintain engagement with donors who are spreading money around this early in the primary, and how to solidify those people as supporters, that'll be fascinating to see.
You were talking about fundraising, and I guess, you know, is that an innovation? I mean, so you have a candidate, you know, Elizabeth Warren, again, who says, I'm not going to do any more of these big money fundraisers. I'm changing the way things are done, to the point where, you know, one of her head fundraisers quit over this. There's a dispute in the middle of the campaign. I mean, I remember in January, other campaigns telling me she was going to drop out because she wasn't going to be able to pay all the people she hired. And then look what happened. She ends up raising a ton of money. Maybe that's an innovation. Maybe she has changed. She set some kind of template anyway, to look at that again in the future.
Holly?
I would just add, I think the choice of the selfie line is a brilliant one. That's such a great idea, Natasha. And part of what makes it work is, maybe this is obvious, but that those people are posting those photos on social media. And so when their friends and their family members see them with Elizabeth Warren or whoever, you know, that makes them interested in the candidate and makes them, you know, maybe take another look or whatever. I think that that's kind of what is genius about it. If this was just on your personal Polaroid, it wouldn't work, right? And I would also just add that the Bernie people would say that some of these things that Warren is doing, particularly with small dollar fundraising, is something that he, you know, he also has led the way on, obviously in 2016, you know, really pioneered the idea of massive email small dollar fundraising and, you know, swearing off big dollar fundraisers in order to do that. And they too are doing some in-house work, on things like, ads, for instance. At least at this point in the game, they're making all of their, you know, ads that they're putting online themselves. And there's also another tech feature that I'm interested in is the apps that the campaigns are using to organize their supporters with. So the Sanders campaign made its own app, the Burn app, in-house, that they're, you know, using to organize. And then the Warren campaign is using this thing called Reach, which basically has been credited with helping AOC win in the primary. And so there's kind of like this battle of the apps going on. And so, again, I think to David's point, whoever ends up being successful will probably, you know, determine how we see whatever the technological innovation was, whether it's, is it the Reach app? Is it the Burn app? Is it, you know, some app that hasn't been created yet?
Guys, let's wrap up quickly by looking forward a little bit. Let's pull out the imaginary Politico crystal ball that allows us to see into the future. If you could ask one question of that crystal ball about what's going to happen between now and the end of the year, just before voting starts, what would be the one question you'd like to know? And not who's going to be ahead in the polls. Tell me what are the big variables that you really are focused on. Let's do one question each for that crystal ball.
I'm happy to start. I guess my question would be where the economy is. And I don't mean the metrics about wages and some of these perhaps more impactful measurements that Democrats talk about, but the top line numbers that tend to drive and help or hurt a president's approval rating. If we really are sliding into the beginnings of a recession, I'd be curious to know where that stands by the end of the fall, and how the candidates react to it, and how the views of the candidates among the Democratic electorate are shaped by where the economy stands in a few months.
Holly?
I feel like I can't do better than that. That's pretty good. Is it cheating if I say who is doing best with Black voters?
That is not.
I think that is pretty much the race, right? Right now, a big part of the reason that Joe Biden is ahead is because he's just crushing everyone else among African American voters. Pete is doing atrociously with Black voters. Elizabeth Warren is not doing well. She's doing well with Black activists. I think she's kind of won a lot of high profile Black activists over, but just has not done well with the electorate there yet. Bernie is doing okay. He's second usually, but he's just way far behind Biden. And, you know, if no one can beat Biden on that front, then I think Biden's got the nomination.
That's a good one. Natasha, the pressure is on going last, but I know you're up for the challenge. What is that question?
Well, the pressure is on. I mean, I guess one variable that could affect the Democratic primary is, you know, where's the impeachment inquiry at that point? And how does that affect, you know, how people position themselves, where they were, and what Democrats are asking for at that point. You know, if you start out the beginning of the year, no one would touch it. No one in the 2020 field was asking for it, would even go near it. And then,